Welcome to the Performance Health Podcast. My name is Tim Karen. Today, Corey and myself are going to be talking about what is driving the decisions of your program. Is it the weight room or is it the actual program? A lot of times we associate whatever program we're writing as completely distinct from the weight room we have, but the weight room actually has a huge influence on what we can do from an exercise selection, how we organize those exercises, and even protocols and methods. It's going to be a deep dive into what are the logistics that we need to manage in terms of a weight room. If you like what you're hearing, please like, subscribe, please share, please leave a review. It makes a huge difference. Also, head over to phpodcast.com. We got a boatload of things going on in terms of new blogs. We got a lot of promos going on for Black Friday. Save 50% off all books and courses. So Strength Deficit, How to Become a Strength Coach. And then you can get over to the courses. Just go to Become a Member. You can look at the Field Guide to Strength Deficit, which is your ultimate companion guide to the book, as well as the Foundations course, which is coming out in January. We're taking pre-enrollment. All of that is 50% off. Just use the Black Friday discount code. Save, save, save. And for a special promo, if you purchase the Strength Deficit Field Guide, I'll do a quick 30-minute conversation with you to set you up for success to implement that with your program. All right, guys, let's talk about weight room driven versus program driven.
Tim, we're back with season 6, continuing our facility design discussion. Today, we're talking about being program-driven versus weight room-driven. What does that mean exactly?
Talked about it last week, that I'm usually going to inherit the weight room. And a lot of times we like to live in this, hey, what is the perfect scenario, the fantasy of I have this facility that I can do everything that I ever imagined program-wise. But one hypothetical would be what would it actually look like. And I think sometimes we start to shape the narrative of training around what I'm usually dealt with and never really actually thinking about pushing your program to an upper limit and having a weight room that's designed to meet your program. And more times than not, we default to a program that may be not congruent, but has to be kind of malleable to the environment we're in. So there's two vectors to really think about this. One being there's a program-driven weight room, meaning that I design the weight room off the program I want to do. For instance, I'm a weightlifting coach, or I'm a speed coach, or I'm a powerlifting coach. I have my philosophy. We've said this line before, and we'll say it again. It's show me your weight room, and I can tell your philosophy. What would that philosophy actually look like in a perfect scenario? And then the other. And I think this is more times than not the default. It's a weight room driven program, meaning that I'm writing a program that is congruent with the facility that I have. Sometimes they are oil and water. And a lot of times I don't think we do enough of a dive into, all right, what is this actual constraint bottleneck that exists within my programming that I have to adjust that weight room or my program to accommodate?
So what should be our first steps? Like, we inherit our weight room, and what should take us down the list of what we should be thinking about.
One of the things that I like to work through with our coaches is, what is your ability? What is your knowledge? And what is your motivation? And these are going to be the big three things to think about when you're trying to design a program or a weight room. And when we think about your ability, there's going to be a couple different silos that we can start to build ability around: speed and movement. And a lot of times, you know, you'll see that there's going to be some sort of limitation in terms of speed, teaching speed progressions. There'll be some limitations in terms of teaching plyometric progressions. And this is a great debate of well, what does a perfect weight room look like? Is it a lot of open space with a lot of ability to move? Well, you might actually have some limitations in terms of developing actual force or developing hypertrophy or muscle tissue, developing maybe more rehabilitation model or return to play model. There's going to be some sort of inherent shortcoming. And the other end of it, it's the, okay, well, what are the bigger ROI things that we talked about last week of racks or barbells and dumbbells, a Pareto principle type of approach, and that could become all consuming. And when we're thinking about, all right, well, the things that I'm going to absolutely need to develop this team, a lot of times they're setting off of what's a weakness, what's a limitation, what's some recurring injuries or constraints or bottlenecks that we have to work through, and we can align or adjust our weight room to accommodate the program that we know would be best practice or ideal for that athlete or that client. Now, as we start to looking through that, gets into this motivation component, right? This aspect of, all right, sometimes we have a lot of things or pieces of equipment that we'll need to get through a work. You know, one of the things that I always look at is how many different drills or different exercises are going to be built in or baked into a workout. Maybe it's 20 to 30 different things. And that means 20 to 30 different things you've got to set up or organize. And that means 20 or 30 different things that someone's got the ability to demonstrate, 20 or 30 things that someone has to be able to explain or understand how to do. There's a lot of logistics that goes into the aspect of that. And then the final aspect with that motivational component, like I have to set up 10 trap bars that weigh 30 kilos, these big ones now, or they take up a huge amount of space, so it's never really stored in a way that's efficient. Or I'm going to set up dozens of velocity-based stuff, or I got to calibrate our chains and bands, or I got to set up weight release hooks, or I'm going to just do an hour setup multiple times a day is probably not worth the actual value we're going to get from the workout. And I'm saying that in a way that hopefully doesn't come off as I'm trying to be lazy. I'm just trying to be ergonomic with that. Just breaking down and building back up a weight room every single day, just from the endless list of things that you're having within a single workout, becomes a nightmare. And you start to see your coaches burn out. You start to see your athletes wane in interest and motivation as they go. And just, it's a battle that you're never going to win. And the simplicity or the feng shui of a room or the elegant design makes all that stuff a lot easier. And one of the areas that we're looking at from inheriting a weight room is zeroing in on what the constraints or the bottlenecks that you have. And if I see, okay, the trap bars are way over there, we're going to use the trap bars every single session. Like that's just a foundational movement of our workout. Or another big one would be a safety bar. Like we now adhere to utilizing safety bars and maybe a hands-free front squat or hands-free safety squat or half-field leg squat. Or maybe we like to do a reverse lunge because we have a lot of throwing athletes and we don't like to have the athletes holding on a bar here or a front squat or back squat position. Then we're going to have the safety bars. But the issue is they're big, they're cumbersome, hard to store in racks. So that means they're going to be set off on a wall or some sort of upright storage in some part of the weight room that's not obstructive to flow. And every single day, we're going to have to pull those bars out and put them into the rack. And a discussion maybe have, like, we're going to take the traditional barbells and put those in storage, and we're going to put the safety bars in every rack. Well, oh, by the way, we're going to be now limited to just doing safety bars. And if I do have an exercise I want to use with a barbell, maybe it's a squat, maybe it's press, maybe it's some sort of deadlift-like pattern, then I got to put in all the barbells back out. And an even worse scenario is I'm in the middle of the group, but I have two or three different bars that I'm going to be using. I'm using a trap bar, a barbell, and a safety bar, and storing all three of those at a single station is impossible. And these are the things that, as we start to break down and go through all your workouts, I could tell you pretty clearly that there's going to be a massive time investment, a massive cost to the quality of the session because coaches are more preoccupied with setting up as opposed to coaching, a massive effect of athletes trying to dodge these landmines, not literal landmines at the rack, I'm talking figurative, that are always in the way, that athletes are just dumping or emptying the bar because they got 20 minutes to finish a workout and they just have to get the bar out of the way and get throwing on their B series or the C series. But all that stuff plays out all the time. And one of the things that you start to look at is, all right, I'm just going to stop using the bars, or I'm going to stop using dumbbells because they're way over there. I'm going to stop using glued hands, or I'm going to stop using this. And you have the piece. And that is a weight room driven program, that the shortcomings of your weight room are now deciding for you what you're going to do within your program. And you start to create this typecast of yourself of like, oh, well, I don't do weightlifting anymore. So I'm not a weightlifting coach. I'm a power coach utilizing barbells and trap bars because those are just easier for me. Sure. I don't think you should typecast yourself, but we do that all the time. Versus what if we just stop, pause, and say, what would be my perfect program that I would be able to utilize these tools in an efficient and organized way, that I am a craftsman and I'm going to have my tool that I absolutely need to get done. Or maybe we could look at it, I'm a painter and I have this complete palette of paints or colors that I can use to create the perfect shading or the perfect amount of balance within that picture or that painting every single time, so I can be as efficient and as organized as possible. And you look at, you know, maybe some comparables of a workshop that has all the tools imaginable, and they're probably using a couple of tools more so than others, but they can have a much bigger bandwidth to handle a lot more complex problems that make beautiful pieces of art or craftsmanship. And I think the same thing with a weight room. But when we're looking at where do we start, it's what am I using majority of the time, right? Am I only barbell and only dumbbell, only kettlebell? And what are the pieces that I have that aren't getting used and why am I not using it? Is it a philosophy thing or is it just a logistic thing? And your logistic test is walking by and testing if there's dust on there. If it's your philosophy thing, there's a clear example of, I need to do a introspection on, oh wait, why am I not using that? It's because the tool is invaluable, or I just got it. It was previous my predecessor's choice, or I just stopped believing it. And then it goes into, now that's taking up space. Now that's an option there that you're just not using. That has a cascading like effect to the rest of the staff of maybe the person at the tip of the spear who doesn't use all the piece of equipment, doesn't believe in it now because their boss doesn't believe in it. And you have this issue of equipment and facility and programming that's not congruent with each other. That if we look at the inventory of the tools in my weight room that I'm using or not using, that I start to create these patterns of feedback loops that might be actually limiting your output in terms of your performance. And the thing that I want you to think about, and if you could pause right now as a listener or you're watching this on YouTube, is stop. Walk around your weight room. What pieces of equipment do you have in that weight room that you haven't used in a while? And start to think about why. And if it's a logistics or a philosophy thing, dig deeper. And if it's logistics, can I organize this or manipulate my environment to make it easier to use or easier to grab or more readily available to insert into my program? If it's a philosophy thing, start to break down, well, how did I come to this conclusion of this piece of equipment no longer is congruent with what I want to do with my athletes anymore and why? And did I make a premature solution and just create this overall framework that omits or doesn't do anything to those tools anymore? And was that a good decision, a prudent decision? Was that a philosophy decision to have a second order effect to make, we're going to be resigned to our fate on this, right? And I think all of this stuff starts to play itself out and you start to see the trends and patterns. Like if you weren't there and your athletes started to work out and they just organically start to do stuff, what would that look like? It's probably a look, feel, and smell like what you decided from a program or weight room driven philosophy.
You've worked with a ton of coaches now. So how do you go about encouraging that creativity? Like you're very introspective, so you model that behavior, but what else do you do to encourage your coaches to do the same?
Practice. And the message is I don't want to be limited by the tools that I have or don't have. And if I have them and I'm not either motivated or knowledgeable, able to do it, I need to practice. If I don't have it, and therefore I can't do it or no opportunity to do it, I need to do some research and say, would this be a worthwhile investment to do? And that could mean I'm going to do a site visit. That could mean I'm going to go to a seminar or course. That could mean I'm going to call some coaches that maybe have these pieces. A great example would be a bell squat. And this is always a really interesting conversation, right? There's the gold standard, which would be more of a pit shark, which is a great piece of equipment, but it's big, it's cumbersome. And maybe you get the extended version that has pull-ups and dips attached to it. It has another pull-up station, a dip station. You can do your belt quiet, you can do your hinges, you can do your walks, you can do all sorts of great stuff. And the utility of that piece, I think, has evolved to a place where I think it's something you should at least consider. But then you start to think about, well, why do I need a belt squat? Was that the knee-jerk reaction to athletes with back pain and not able to do a back squat or a front squat or a deadlift? And I'm going to start to supplement that with a less of a axial loaded position like a belt squat. How did that come to that conclusion? Do I have back pain? Do I think this is going to be a valuable tool? Like I knock on wood, but I don't have any back injuries. So my default isn't really going to doing a belt squat. And then you go, okay, well, I really believe in belt squat because I have back pain, or it's a really good tool for athletes that do have back pain, or it's just a good way to teach a squat without utilizing a barbell. And then you're okay, well, where are we going to put it? Okay, maybe I have 6 to 12 racks and they take up the majority of my weight room. And then we start to look at that. All right, well, where would that be that's in proximity to that athlete that needs it? And maybe you start to develop, this might sound crude, but like a weight room leper colony, that you have 2 or 3 racks allocated to injured athletes they need to be within proximity of that to facilitate their needs when they're training. Or maybe you have a couple scattered throughout the weight room that's within some sort of distance that is capable of all those racks to be able to access within a series of A series or B series. Maybe it's just, hey, I'm going to have a separate closed off room that I'm going to allow for my return to play athletes to train out of. It could be a whole host of things. But as we start to break down, that's real estate. That's maybe a single exercise piece, like a leg curl or leg extension or a pull down, or maybe that's a dumbbell area, or maybe that's a pit shark or a belt squat, or maybe that's a piece of equipment that takes up a lot of space and in exchange for something else. And we're all going to be victim of wanting to get return on investment. And we got on a table, say we need this tool, the school, the organization, my business needs to make an investment into this. And at what cost is it? Are we overly prioritizing that in the exchange for something that wasn't as absolutely necessary as we wanted it to be, but we wanted to get it in there, and now we're overly utilizing it. And now we're sacrificing some other stuff like flow or transition time or just the simplicity of explaining to someone why they might need a belt squat or any other piece of equipment, relatively speaking, to what we get at the rack. And that process of inventorying that and looking through, like, is it an ability? Is it a knowledge thing? Is it a motivation thing? Is it, do I have it or not have it? Am I willing to put in the effort to learn what the value of that is? There's an endless list of things we can inventory. But I guess an even more simple way to look at it is if you find that there's a blind spot in your program and that you just simply can't address with your tools at your disposal, and you start to look at it, I have it, I'm just not using it, can come down to pretty simply a motivation, knowledge, or ability kind of framework. I got to teach them, I got to rep it, I got to practice it, or I got to just encourage constantly to get over there. Or on the other note, it's the I don't have it, I got to research it, I got to get some sort of repetition on it, and then I got to see how that would fit in my program. And that might come at the expense of something you currently have within your weight room, and you might need to adjust that space to be able to accommodate that tool that creates a blind spot in your program.
Do you have any tips for finding those blind spots? Because obviously we're all biased, so we might not be open to that. So how do we go about, you know, exploring that and finding out what our blind spots are?
Patterns are always going to exist. And one of the things that you start to look through in your end of the year type of inventory or postmortem, what injuries did you continuously have? And I guess this is like going to be a tangent, but if you don't believe it, you can't reduce the rate of injury and through training. Like, I think you're misguided. There's blunt force trauma. If someone just runs through my leg and fractures my femur or my tibia, like, sure, nothing going to prevent that. But a non-contact soft tissue injury from just changing direction or trying to decelerate, or just too much stress in an area, that's just a lack of preparedness. And in my mind, that is just a clear representation of the things that you were overly focused or myopically focused within your program. And that's a reason to start to look at your program in a different light, that I'm severely under addressing either a tissue or a quality or a vector or plane, and I need to address that in some way, shape, or form within my programming. But that blind spot, that's the easiest, most significant one. Maybe there's a weakness or a gap in your programming in terms of rate of force development. And if you have gravity-based tools, it could be as simple as grabbing chains or bands to create accommodating resistance. If it's I lack space and I can't do plyos into the level I want or speed progressions that I want, what could I do to supplement that at a rep? And there's plenty of things that we can facilitate rate of force development within my program to allow for those things to occur. But when we're breaking it down, maybe if it's just like creating hypertrophy, right? That we look like Jane and we want to play like Tarzan kind of mentality. And I hope that doesn't come off as misogynist. The metaphor really stands out to, if we aren't developing muscle to have a creased cross-sectional muscle area, we're leaving a lot in the table in terms of force or rate of force development. And sometimes just about localized tissue development and getting them on a fixed machine, a single joint machine that has a lot of value in either stressing a muscle group or stressing an area, that could be a conversation to be had. And the post-mortem in that, what was our goals at the beginning? So pre-mortem is before, post-mortem is at the end and saying, here was our objectives. We want to get faster. We want to get stronger. We want to reduce the rate of injury, maybe not in that order. And then we get at the end of the year and we look at a postmortem, like, did we get faster? Yes or no? And then we start to break off of like, well, what were the limiting factor or the constraints or the blind spots that we have or the gaps that we had that didn't allow us to get faster to the level we want? And faster is not a relative term. Did we run across the line faster, whether it's a straight ahead linear speed? Did we change direction more efficiently in a pre-programmed or a scripted change of direction drill, like a 5-10-5 or an L drill or a shuttle? Or maybe we do an open-sided game and we'll just say we're going to go for a period of time and winners or losers, et cetera, et cetera. And then we start to look at, okay, well, I can't develop the qualities that I need to express myself to go faster. And all I have are tools that make me stronger. Might need to address that with different types of resistance or different pieces that allow for increased rate of force. Then I look at the next level of, okay, my pre-mortem said I want to get faster. And then I look at the next part is I want to get bigger. Okay, well, did we increase lean muscle mass? Did we improve the body composition to allow that athlete to play at a higher level? And if I'm have a bunch of free weight stuff and I have these no machines, we don't believe in anything. I talked about my philosophy last week of compound closed kinetic chain exercises. That probably tells you I get a lot of racks, a lot of bars, a lot of dumbbells, a lot of kettlebells, a lot of objects that are going to be gravity based and a multi-joint ground based environment. But I am severely underdeveloping tissues of the posterior chain, like the hamstring or the calf or the gastroc. Or if I look at maybe even bicep or tricep, or if I look at pecs and lats, if I look at underdeveloped areas that are kind of leaving this breadcrumb trail of, oh, wow, there's a lot of gaps in my program, I might need to get some single use isolated based machines. And the taboo nature of like, I commit to this philosophy, but I have this aversion to doing anything outside of that philosophy because it ruined my identity. But I have a complete blind spot in my program from not developing muscle tissues at a level that I should be. And I can hammer it all I want with time under tension or volume, but there's just going to be anytime we're under load in a gravity-based environment with a closed kinetic chain, compound multi-joint movement, then I'm going to find the path of least resistance and find some way to create mechanical advantage. And machines take that away. Machines do not allow you to manipulate your center of mass to develop a targeted tissue. And I think one of the epidemics you see with most strength conditioning programs are squats look like hinges and hinges look like squats. And a large part of that is like underdevelopment of the tissues associated with that. We lack the tensile strength at that threshold mechanical advantaged or disadvantaged position to overcome that load. So we accommodate that by shifting our center of mass. And that takes tension and stress away from a muscle group. There's a great way to circumvent that. It's machines and it's been around for a long time. And it's what bodybuilders know. But if that was part of my pre-mortem and I don't have the tools to address that, and I'm only leaning in hard on squats, hinges, pushes, and pulls, and I have completely underdeveloped muscle groups or completely low, I have a lowered ceiling of muscular development and decreased cross-sectional muscle area, overall lean muscle mass, I might need to address, I have limited tools to get the job done. And the final aspect would be reducing the rate of injury. And it could be in form of like, all right, I got racks, I got dumbbells, I got barbells, but I have no space to move and operate, that I can't hit deceleration, or I can't have athletes work through different movement preparation or corrective exercise or pillar exercises because the tools that I have are in a fixed plane and only go up and down. And I'm not addressing the architecture of a muscle or connective tissue, and I need more space. It could mean I need to remove some pieces of equipment, especially if I have an abundance of racks that I'm not using to the full degree. And if, let's say, I have like 20 something stations and I'm only using 10 of them on a recurring basis, I could keep it because I want this thing to look like Stonehenge, and I want this to be a place that people look at as a mecca and visit, like, look how many racks we have. Or I could go, well, I don't need that many racks, and I could definitely use that space to do different movement in all three planes of motion, all three vectors. And I need a med ball wall, and I need some space to do some other things outside of the rack to facilitate just developing an athlete in a more robust way. But that pre and post-mortem, and actually having a really deep dive of, do I have the knowledge to change this? Do I have the ability to change this? And do I have the motivation to change that? Is paramount to making sure that we have a weight room and a performance program that allows for continuous development. And if I don't have it, I got to figure out a way to get it. If I don't know how to do it, I got to figure out how to learn how to do it. And if I don't have the ability to, I got to figure out how to demonstrate. And these are all foundational to making sure that we have a weight room that's always specific. And there's a rule in biology of all environments and all systems of law that every year we learn and we grow and we change. And the omittance of something that we previously did that we have greater success with isn't you giving up on who you are as a person. It's you evolving with an ever-changing environment that's complex and never going to be the same from one day to the next. And the environment or the ecosystem that you have in your weight room needs to match that ever-changing dynamic you have, right? Like even just a simple philosophy change as a program, right? Like I work a lot with football and I work majority of the time with triple option based offenses. And a lot of that is just having a bunch of offensive linemen that are road graders, D backs that are just going to be able to churn their feet. So just get them strong, get them really, really strong. And we got to stop the triple option. So that means my front seven needs to be really, really strong. So my weight rooms need to match that philosophy. But let's say that I go and get a job because I'm that good and we get to a power four school and we go to a spread style option or more pro style. And we need our perimeter players to be really explosive and cover a lot of ground. And we needed our front four to be really strong and cover a lot of space, but be able to block and get by really big people. And then we need our kind of middle or our mids or the people that are playing combination positions like tight end, fullback, or H-backs now, linebackers, big safeties. They need to be not only cover a lot of ground, but they need to be all really good at the line of scrimmage. You need to be really good at everything. And I look at my weight room of, okay, I need a lot of space for my perimeter players to allow these athletes to expand their concentric circle to move and be explosive and dynamic. And I need the tools to get my front five in my offensive line and my front four in my defensive line to get really big and strong. So I need my time-tested proven methods to do that. And then I need these combination players to kind of be in both, right? They need to be in both spaces. I need a big space for these guys, athletes, to move around and express themselves in a dynamic way. But I also need them to have a lot of lean muscle mass, a lot of strength. And one of the things that you find now in modern college football, and this is, I think, a good thing, but it's a really big problem to work through as a strength and conditioning coach, is a lot of these athletes are playing multiple sports or they're not playing football for a very long time. So strength and conditioning is kind of new to them. And there's a great upward mobility in getting these guys really big and strong because it's an untapped resource. But there's also an equal and most importantly, a really big need to develop these guys in space. And having a program that allows for them to do everything has to be considered. And that pre and post-mortem, that evaluation of what are my blind spots, that connectedness to the philosophy of the system that we're running as offensive or defense, football, or whatever we're doing in like baseball, lacrosse, soccer, basketball, et cetera, all needs to be considered in terms of I need to make sure that my weight room is facilitating a better output on the field or on the court.
Man, you just wrapped it up perfectly. I think that seems like the perfect spot to end here. This was great, Tim. Thank you.
Hell yeah.
Just drop the mic and get out of here.